Welcome on in. Good afternoon. Hello, everybody. I'm Avi Wolf-Manero.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. This is Studio 2, the best live conversation in Philadelphia. Avi, have you ever had to lose a significant amount of weight?
Can't say I have. You know, I've been a little overweight from time to time, but no, never had to like shed a lot of pounds.
Yeah, the most I've ever lost was 40 pounds.
40 pounds.
40 pounds. It took me 8 months. It was really hard.
Yeah.
I was having some health challenges and I kind of kept it off for the most part.
Wow.
And so today we're going to be talking about weight loss and we're going to be talking about Ozempic and similar drugs that have revolutionized weight loss in recent years. You've probably heard about it, folks. Ozempic.
Yeah, you can't escape it.
You know. Yeah. Anyway, I sang
badly. You want to sing the whole song? I got time, so yeah.
No, but it's really sort of changed the game. And so our big question of the day is, would you be willing to take Ozempic or similar drugs to lose weight? How are drugs like Ozempic and Wegovy changing the game when it comes to weight loss? We want to hear from you, 888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org. I mean, my mom's using Ozempic. She's diabetic. It has significantly changed her life.
Yeah.
And you hear all these positive stories, but there are people who don't need it who are using it. To lose a few pounds, but they don't have diabetes or what have you.
Yeah.
But and the question is, like, how will this change the way people view themselves, the way people view their bodies? How will this change healthcare?
Yeah.
Lots of questions here.
So many of the biggest changes don't happen all at once, right?
No,
they happen, not, I don't want to say slowly, but sort of in a gradual way.
Mm-hmm.
And the stat that sticks out to me, according to the CDC, the percentage of American adults over age 20 with obesity is 41.9%.
Yeah, a lot of people impact it.
Well, are we entering an era now where that goes down to 30%, to 20%, to 10%? And if so, how does that change society?
Yeah,
so much of society is adapted to that reality. So, you know, I always get lost in this big picture stuff. But for me, I'm just fascinated by that question because the power of these drugs does seem to be pretty awesome.
Yeah. And they're treating weight loss like a disease, like a chronic disease. So the big question, would you be willing to take Ozempic or similar drugs to lose weight? And how are these drugs changing the game when it comes to weight loss? The number is 888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org.
Changing the game.
Yes.
That's the transition.
Changing the game. Yes.
That's the transition.
For our
to,
trio of news stories.
No surprise. We're going to start by talking about the latest news around the Sixers proposed, and yes, it's still proposed, arena in Market East. Yesterday afternoon, as we teased yesterday on the show, Mayor Sherelle Parker told the public where she stands on this issue. She supports the Sixers' proposal to build that arena on the western half of what is now the Fashion District Mall. She released a statement about 3.5 minutes long yesterday on X. A lot of the pros that she laid out were related to the economic impact of the arena. Let's hear a bit of what Mayor Parker had to say.
More than $1.3 billion of private investment in our city. Hundreds and hundreds of jobs for Philadelphians. It means an economic opportunity plan, quite frankly, the likes of which have never been seen in our city.
Okay, there you have it. So this is not the end of the story.
No.
There will be a bills package that will be sent to city council that could come as soon as late October. A date to keep in mind, the last day for council this year to vote on anything is December 12th before they go on their holiday break. So it's possible this could all get wrapped up by then, but not a certainty. And we, of course, don't know how city council is going to vote on all of this. Only a handful of members have said publicly how they feel about the project. And so, you know, a majority of them would still need to approve this for it to go through.
Yeah, and there's still going to be hearings.
Hearings.
So there is going to be a lot of community discussion around this.
And maybe lawsuits.
Yeah.
We'll see.
We'll see. But, you know, clearly the mayor is on the side of this arena. She wants to keep the Sixers in Philadelphia because you know that New Jersey was lurking, offering $400 million in tax incentives. Delaware raised their hand, offering space.
Yeah.
But she wanted them here in Philadelphia. And there's a lot of folks who want this arena to be here, like the unions, the African-American Chamber of Commerce, But, you know, Chinatown, again, and some others who live in the area are against it. So we'll see what happens.
But it's not a done deal, but it's a major inflection point.
And it's also, you know, when the mayor lays it down, that makes it easier for council members and other people to lean toward the arena.
And we don't have any, you know, inside information but Sherelle Parker is a talented politician.
She is.
And
with strong relationships with a lot of folks.
She was on city council for a long time. You have to think she's had at least those conversations and probably has a pretty good idea that she has enough support to get this through.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, I don't think she would come out and make this message, but you never know. Crazy things happen. We mentioned the possibility of lawsuits. So we're going to keep following this, as I'm sure you will. And I'm guessing it'll come up again on the show.
Yeah, for sure. Moving on to another Philly story. The popular Instagram account, you probably heard of it, is called No Gun Zone.
No Gun Zone.
Well, it has been suspended and could be permanently banned on Instagram. The creator of this, we talked about this on a show.
We did indeed. Yes,
we did. We did a show all about the rise of social media news pages, news and information pages, and competing with journalist organizations like ours, right? The creator...
Oftentimes out-competing us, to be fair.
Yeah. The creator is a Philly-based guy. His name is Terrence Harrell. He started the account back in 2014, and he built it up to 352,000 followers. Only to have it shut down last month. And why was it shut down? Well, Instagram says that he allegedly violated the platform's community guidelines repeatedly.
So describe to folks what's on No Gun Zone.
Yeah, No Gun
Zone. It's a mishmash.
Yeah, it is. It's basically a news source for Philadelphians that look at crime, it looks at gun violence, and it reposts a lot of local news stories.
Often very raw.
Yeah, very raw. But it also does stories about small businesses.
Right.
And it helped people find their wallets or cars that were stolen, like all kinds of things
and
like that.
And oftentimes this page, the guy who runs this page, he'll get like tips about crimes.
Mm-hmm.
Or he'll signal boost someone who's looking for a niece or a nephew who's gone missing.
He's like, actually helped people find lost family
members.
It's
almost like a community cork board.
Yes.
But it's very unfiltered.
Yeah.
Or it was.
But the nature of some of his posts have been very graphic. And so the page has gotten some pushback from Instagram as well as people from the public who said, hey, man, you've gone too far.
Yeah.
But to me, this issue raises, the debate or highlights the debate about the citizen run news and information pages that only exist on social media.
Mm-hmm.
What about their reliability, right? There is no First Amendment right to have an IG or TikTok or YouTube page.
Totally.
So these companies can literally censor or remove a page and there's nothing you can do about it.
You're right. I mean, so this page allegedly violates some policy set at a campus in California somewhere. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, a lot of people in Philadelphia
who come to rely on No Gun Zone
lose a news source, right? Mm-hmm. And so the gatekeeper here is really just the one company. It's Meta in this case, but there are other platforms, right? We could see TikTok go away altogether at some point. You know what I mean? So it does feel very tenuous. And whether or not you agree with Meta's decision here or not, I think you should, like you said, acknowledge the fact that a lot of people get their news and information this way, and it can be sort of like zapped away at any moment, which is a weird new reality that we're living in.
Yeah. I mean, 352,000 followers, that's a lot of people relying. And he actually got an award from the
City
Pen
Council.
And Pencil. And the Pen and Pencil Club.
Oh, and the Pen and Pencil too. Yeah.
For being a community news source.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So speaking of, I guess, brave new worlds, let's go down to Delaware for our final story. So, you know, Dick's Sports, they're a retailer, sells sporting goods,
like
equipment.
Dick's Sports.
Yeah. It's like a big warehouse full of all the types of gear that you could possibly imagine, your cleats and your shin guards and all that. Well, they're starting a new concept. They've started over the last few years, but they're bringing it to our region now in Delaware, Northern Delaware, Brandywine Town Center. It's called Dick's House of Sport.
Ooh.
And what distinguishes it from like a typical Dick's sporting goods store is that it's not just supplies and goods. It's a lot of experiential stuff like a rock wall, rock climbing wall and a putting green. And it's sort of a bet on going big. Because we know retail, in-person retail has suffered.
Yeah.
With the rise of online.
Mm-hmm.
And the counter move for a lot of traditional retailers is, well, you don't just come to our store to buy stuff. You come here to enjoy yourself.
Yeah.
Right?
And try things out. Yeah.
To try things out, to have a good time. Mm-hmm. And so Dick's, we, I think, are both kind of fascinated by this concept. Dick's is sort of testing it out in a few markets, including in northern Delaware. It's supposed to open in early October.
Wow, that's soon.
That's really soon. Yeah, yeah. October 11th. But I am just fascinated by what it says about the future of retail, right? I mean, this could be what we come to expect from an in-person shopping experience.
Yeah, I think it seems super cool. And I could see myself driving down to Delaware because it's going to be the only one in like 140-mile radius. I could see myself doing that.
Really? The rock wall?
Maybe not the rock wall, but one of the other experiences.
Green.
Yeah, maybe I would definitely do the putting green. But I mean, I like big stores like that. I think about going to IKEA sometimes, right?
I get a
couple meatballs in the little cafe, you know, and hang out, look at the stuff. I mean, it's like an experience.
You should try the rock wall.
I should try the rock wall.
Send me a video.
Yeah. Why won't you try the rock wall?
I'll try the rock wall.
You can send me a video.
We'll both try the rock wall.
Yeah.
No, but I do think we might do a show later just about the change in retail experience.
Because it is shift. And they have no choice.
And they have no choice.
Because people are
shopping.
They're
being forced to adapt.
Yeah.
And will it work? We'll see. Coming up in our main segment in just a few moments, we're going to talk about Ozempic, GLP-1s, weight loss drugs that are taking over the world. And we want to know, would you be willing to try one of these? 888-477-949, studio2 at WHYY.org. And we will be right back.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
All right. Welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2 on WHYY. Hello. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. You probably know someone taking a GLP-1 like Ozempic or Mounjaro, or maybe you're one of those people. Millions of Americans are using these drugs to treat diabetes, obesity, or just to shed a few pounds. And with 70% of Americans overweight or obese, these prescription medications could have an enormous impact on health and on healthcare.
But not everyone who needs them has access to them. And a lot of people, just as you said, Cherry, are taking them for cosmetic reasons. So today we want to look at just how revolutionary these drugs are and their larger impact on our culture. And our question to you this hour is this: would you be willing to take Ozempic or similar drugs to lose weight? How are drugs like Ozempic and Wegovy changing the game when it comes to weight loss? Email us, studio2 at WHYY.org, or call 888-477-9499.
And we have a trio of guests with us, but I want to bring in our first two guests that are in studio. We have David Sarwer, director of the Center for Obesity Research and Education at Temple University's College of Public Health, and Mara Gordon, assistant professor of family medicine at Cooper Medical School at Rowan University. Welcome to you both to Studio 2.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Dr. Gordon, I'd love to start with you. It's a little bit confusing for me right now trying to get my head around what is out there in the market and how effective it generally is at this point. Can you give us a little bit of a lay of the land? Because we hear that word miracle drug, revolutionary. Like, what are the proven effects and kind of what's out there right now?
Absolutely. Happy to chat about that. So I'm a primary care doc. I take care of adults and kids, and I practice what I like to call size-inclusive medicine, which basically means that I don't yell at my patients to try to lose weight.
That sounds good, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, I say it kind of tongue-in-cheek, but you'd be surprised how revolutionary it is. A lot of people who live in bigger bodies, they're sort of any experience in healthcare is just marred by stigma, discrimination. So I am on a crusade to try to end that. That being said, I do prescribe GLP-1 agonists. I've been using them the entire time I've been in practice as a physician.
How long is that, by the way?
I graduated medical school in 2015.
Oh, that's a long time. Okay, yeah.
So I've been using them for years. They've been around for years. And they are amazing medications. I think that's really important to get out of the way, even though I have some questions about what role they play culturally. And I think it's important to consider the role of fat phobia in the way that people ask for them and think about them. They're great medications, and I'm very grateful to the researchers who developed them. So I started using them for diabetes. That was sort of their original indication to help lower blood sugar, essentially. And over time, I noticed this in my clinical practice that people tended to lose weight while using them. And there was a big seminal study that came out in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2021 that basically sort of established what clinicians and researchers had long suspected, which is that these medications can be used in patients who do not have diabetes specifically for the purpose of losing weight. And that was a big practice-changing study. I remember when it came out, I said, some people are going to be getting very rich off of these meds. Yeah. It was kind of obvious what kind of commercial potential it had. And so now there's been a lot of media frenzy, of course. And
welcome to Studio 2, by the way.
Totally. Yeah. There's just a lot of focus on these medications. And, weekly in my clinic, I have patients asking for them.
So how do they work? Like, tell us how... Yeah, and give us the list of drugs that work this way. But how exactly do they cause you to lose weight?
Great question. I don't think we know, which is kind of amazing. Mm. So they're kind of these mystery drugs. They are called GLP-1 agonists. There are certain medications that are both called GLP-1 agonists and GIP agonists, which are sort of combination drugs. And we don't totally understand how they work. They seem to act on sort of delayed gastric emptying, which means that the stomach empties slower. They make patients feel fuller longer. Yeah. They increase insulin, decrease glucagon, which is kind of the opposite of insulin. But it's still kind of a mystery. There's a lot that we don't understand about exactly how they work.
I feel like this is a difficult question to answer in a straightforward way, but can you give us a sense of how much weight people lose just isolating just the effect of these drugs, right? Because there's other things you can do. There's diet, there's exercise. We know about that. But when we try to isolate the impact of these drugs specifically on weight, like what do we know, I guess?
Yeah. So first of all, I'll say that we do know that diet and exercise don't actually seem to result in sustained weight loss for people, right? That's been pretty well studied. There's a lot of meta-analyses, systematic reviews that show that over time, people who lose weight through diet and exercise tend to regain it. That being said, what I tell my patients, I think vegetables are great. I think exercise is great. There's so many health benefits to moving your body regularly. And what I tell my patients is, I actually don't care if you lose weight. I do care that you exercise, mm-hmm. right? So I would argue that exercise is actually probably more important than a number on the scale, sort of regular exercise. And I see this in my clinical practice all the time. I mean, there's a lot of robust evidence that exercise can be good for you even if you don't lose weight. So that's really important. But we do see that people who are taking GLP-1 agonists and who can stay on them, and I think that's a really important point, that we have some early evidence. I've seen some reports showing that the majority of people who start these medications stop them. And we don't totally understand why, if it's due to side effects or due to cost or inaccessibility or unavailability of the medications. But if people are able to stay on them, clinically, I sometimes see maybe 10 to 20% of their body weight.
10 to 20%.
Wow, that's a significant amount of weight. I want to bring in a caller. We have Karen from Wilmington, Delaware, who wants to talk about the side effects. Karen, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Sure. Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. So I wanted to relate a personal experience that a friend of mine had. Her husband was pre-diabetic and was prescribed Wegovy. And he took one shot and unfortunately had projectile vomiting, which she had to clean up and then help him recover from. So that was very unpleasant. And then he did not take that particular medication again. So then I have also read a number of feature articles on CNN about people who have taken these drugs and had rather unpleasant side effects. One woman complained of very sulfurous burps where she would be talking and feel this, just have this very rancid smell coming up from undigested food in her stomach. And I'm wondering, because, if it's slowing down gastric emptying, when you go see a GI, gastroparesis is an actual medical problem. Usually you don't want food to stay in your stomach for a long time. You certainly don't want it sitting in there rotting. And then my question is, how does that contribute to colon cancer? Because the prevalence of colon cancer is rising for, you know, I mean, in all areas for all age groups.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it seems like, you know,
there's a lot to unpack.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there. So Karen. Definitely feeling some skepticism from Karen, Karen in Wilmington, Delaware. Dr. Moragordan, you were listening to that. Mm-hmm. What did you take away from Karen's comments? And you know, how common are some of those things that she's describing?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, quite common.
Quite common.
Yeah, I would say that this is a pretty common experience that I see in my primary care practice. I think the side effects can be significant. I have patients who decide to stop the medications and they say, you know what, I'd rather be fat than lose 10 pounds and feel terrible every day, right? Mm-hmm. So I respect that. And part of my job as a size inclusive doctor is to respect the ways that people may not always prioritize weight loss in their lives, right? I have other patients who do great on them, who tolerate the medications fine, who do lose weight on them. So I don't think we have a great way of predicting yet who's going to experience those significant side effects and who's not, but they are extremely common.
And I would also imagine we don't know how these drugs are going to evolve. Mm-hmm. It's a pretty new class of drugs, right? And I'd heard that they might go from shots to pills, and I don't know, maybe they'll be able to address some of these side effects as well. I mean, how I guess, new are we on this journey to figuring out what GLP-1s really are and what they do to your body?
I mean, my sense is relatively new, but I mean, they've also been around for a while.
Yeah.
You know, and they were actually, when I most often prescribed them sort of early on, it was sort of in an oral formulation. I'm not sure of the timeline if they were started as injected drugs or oral drugs. I'm not sure if you know the answer to that question.
Yeah, David, sorry.
Yeah. In terms of the history of that, I have less information. I do know, back to your point, though, that we are heading towards an era where we're likely going to see these medications in pill form. I want to come back to this issue of the side effects, because I do think that we do hear a lot of these very profound and concerning examples of patients who are having these really weird, atypical, you know, back to what the caller was saying when she referenced CNN. I remember the day, actually, that their banner headline was people complaining about gastric paralysis from the GLP-1s. Mm-hmm. And in this era of everything going on in the world, that was their lead story.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think in some ways those anecdotes and those stories are a reflection of the popularity of this topic, that good, bad, or indifferent, this discussion is getting a lot of traction, which means there's a lot of good information out there and there's a lot of inaccurate information out there. And so I think it's really important that for individuals who are thinking about using these medications, that they go and they have informed conversations with their physicians about the pros and the cons, and not necessarily be listening to the experience of a neighbor or a friend who said, I had this really atypical, strange result, because these medications can be really effective when prescribed appropriately, monitored carefully, and with certain patients. And we shouldn't lose sight of that in the noise that's getting caught up in the mass media around these medications.
Yeah. And by the way, if you want to weigh into this conversation, our question for you is, would you be willing to take Ozempic or similar drugs to lose weight? And how are drugs like these changing the game when it comes to weight loss? You can email us at studio2@whyy.org or call 888-477-9499. And before, I want you to parse through the side effects, but I want to bring in a caller who I think is teeing this up. Mary from Bensalem says her doc will not prescribe Ozempic, and there's some reasons for that. Mary, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment here?
Hi, I'm here. I've been researching GL1s for years now. My doctor is a type 1 diabetic. I've went to her many times. I don't fit the criteria for prescription coverage, but I do fit the criteria for overweight and a rising A1C. If it's covered by prescription, your copays are affordable. If it's not covered by prescription, you are looking at up to $1,600 a month for the medication. She's concerned about the long-term studies that aren't done on things such as pancreatitis, inflammation of the colon. She's seeing a lot of patients that are malnourished because they just cannot eat because of absolutely no appetite. I'm interested in it, but I'm still cautious. The availability is a problem.
Yeah.
Many people are going to compounding companies that are making compounds, which aren't the same as serums. So there's a lot of questions out there, and it's a long-term, lifetime medication.
Yes, and
people are using their savings accounts to lose weight.
Yeah, yeah. Thank
you.
Let me bring an email actually from Renee.
Yeah,
thank you, Mary. Ben Salem. Renee has the same kind of concern. I've been using it for the past 3 months as a diabetic. It's helped me tremendously, but I may have to stop because even with health insurance and manufacturing discounts, it cost me $375
wow.
per month. And then she ends with OMG.
So this is the $1 million. This is, well, it's probably more than $1 million.
Trillion dollar question,
but this is the huge issue with these medications. They have tremendous promise. They fit in. If you look at the history of evidence-based interventions for weight loss, they fit in a space in getting patients a 10 to 15% weight loss that we typically have not seen from previous generations of medications. It's not as large as what we see from metabolic and bariatric surgery, but that discussion of utilization is for another time. The challenge with these medications is simply this, is utilization and access.
Mm-hmm.
That going back to where you started this segment, 70% of Americans have overweight and they're on the pathway potentially to obesity. And part of that 70% already have obesity, the disease of obesity. And we need more interventions that are available to help those individuals. These medications fit this niche, but the people who need them most aren't necessarily having readily available access to them because of availability of the compounds and also because of cost. And this is going to be a situation where we're going to need the third-party payers and the pharmaceutical companies to essentially figure this out for all of us, because whether we're talking about $1,000 a month or even $360 a month with coupons and discounts, that's a significant amount of out-of-pocket expense for many, many Americans.
And then you end up with a real inequity in who has access. Mm-hmm. And then eventually down the road, who is suffering from the sort of the effects of obesity, right?
Absolutely. And that's part of the equation up front, that we know that obesity differentially impacts people from underserved and underrepresented groups.
Yeah.
So we have these effective treatments that are largely unavailable to the percentage of the population who could use them and benefit from them the most.
Yeah, and I want to read a couple comments. Portia has said, I'm on Mounjaro for diabetes. It did help my weight loss journey that I had already started, but I did not seek it out. And if I had not become diabetic, I would not have pursued it. And I want to shout out my mom, who's been on Ozempic for 5 months. She says, after 40 years battling diabetes with 2 daily infections and 1 pill, now my A1C is 6.2, and I'm being taken off 2 other diabetes meds. She also lost 18 pounds. So she's very happy about that. But I want to ask the question about side effects, because could you tell us what is an actual side effect versus the things people talk about but may not actually be a real side effect, Mara?
Yeah, of course. So I think the side effects that I see most commonly in my clinical practice, which are also reflected in the scientific literature, are stomach upset, feeling like a sensation of heartburn, sometimes vomiting, sometimes frequent loose stools. I think those are the ones that are reflected in the scientific studies and what I see in my practice. Yeah.
But so it seems like the side effects are fairly limited, though.
I mean, I think that depends on the individual patient. And that's something I keep coming back to in my clinical practice. I mean, I have patients who just really feel terrible on these medications. And I don't want to discount that lived experience that they have, right? That they shouldn't feel pressure to lose weight at all costs.
Yeah.
And, you know, feeling bad every day, right? They get to define what their health priorities are. And that's my job as a physician.
Yeah. And want to bring in our...
Let's bring in another caller here. This is Charlotte from Morristown, New Jersey, who wants to talk about body image. And you talked about right there, Dr. Gordon, the idea of shame. So perhaps Charlotte has something to add to that. So Charlotte's on line 3 from Morristown, New Jersey. Charlotte, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, good afternoon. My comment is I am Gen X, and for most of my adolescence, I struggled with eating disorder. And I feel like the glamorization part of these drugs with the celebrities who are taking them and losing the weight is just further contributing to that ideal that women should be skinny, you know, at all costs. And also the other thing I wanted to comment on is what finally helped me be in recovery is I became a vegan at first for health reasons and then for ethical reasons. So I have a whole belief system now set on being healthy mentally and physically. And I wish people would talk more about the benefits of a plant-based diet in terms of how to lose weight and just how to stay healthy. Yeah. And happy, really.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, by the way, Charlotte in Morristown, New Jersey. Dr. Gordon, you were listening to that. What did you take away from Charlotte's comment?
Yeah, I mean, I always say these medications are really, really good at specific things, right?
Yeah.
So they're great for lowering your hemoglobin A1C, maybe 1% to 2%, right? They're good at maybe 10% of body weight loss. They're good at protecting cardiovascular health. They're not going to fix everything in your life. And I think that our society is so fatphobic, so obsessed with the idea that skinny is best, which is truly bound up in so much racism, so much misogyny, ageism, right? That, you know, my patients walk in saying, okay, this medicine's going to fix everything. It's going to fix my marriage, fix my relationship with my kids, fix my working life. And I'm like, slow down, slow down. It's good for your heart, good for your blood sugar, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. But it's not a miracle. And I think until we start advocating for a more just society that's really, really working to make people of all body sizes, all body colors, all ages feel, you know, content and at peace in the bodies that they have, we're still going to have hierarchies of bodies. Not everybody's going to look like a supermodel if they take these meds.
Yeah.
And I want to go back to, mm-hmm. to where Charlotte started her comments. I agree with her completely. If we were to have been doing the show a year ago and you were to ask me, what do I think about these medications? My response would have been that the mass media hype and the celebrity attention is out ahead of the science. But barely a week goes by now that there's not a new article that's coming out of the top medical journals in the world talking about the health benefits of these medications. Yeah. But unfortunately, in the public discourse, it's gotten caught up in, is, you know, Ozempic face, and is this a cosmetic procedure? These are not medications that are designed for cosmetic purposes. And unfortunately, it distracts from the larger issue at hand, which is the need to focus on this significant public health issue.
Can we talk about that, actually?
Yeah.
Because, sure.
Yeah. Let's be clear, right, that mm-hmm. a lot of people have other health complications mm-hmm. that are linked to obesity, right?
Absolutely.
And if we have a class of medications that can severely curtail the number of people who are obese or overweight, or at least just sort of like 10 to 20% drop their weight, that's going to have other health effects in mass potentially, right?
Absolutely.
And I mean, can you give us a sense of what that might look like? And maybe it's an optimist take, but what could that look like?
So the could is the operative here, yeah. Because while we do see more clinical trial evidence coming out, we're seeing more evidence in real world practice, which is very encouraging. A lot of these results are still relatively short term, meaning we're seeing what's the impact on hemoglobin A1C and blood pressure and fatty liver disease in the first year or two after being on these medications. Right. I think a lot of us are concerned that if patients are not prepared to be on these medications for the duration of their lives, that chances are they're going to be at risk to regain and that those conditions may in fact continue to worsen. But if we use metabolic and bariatric surgery as an analogy, what do we see? With significant weight losses of about 30% of an individual's body weight, we see not only profound improvements in weight-related comorbidities, but in some cases, they're knocked into remission. Mm. So conditions like type 2 diabetes, mm-hmm. like hypertension, like sleep apnea, sometimes go away from any of these patients right. with that significant and sustained weight loss.
Can I follow up there? Because one of the things that I read about was Ozempic babies and women who actually had PCOS, but because, and which is polycystic ovarian syndrome, and were able to, could not conceive, but after, you know, losing the weight, have been able to successfully get pregnant. Can you talk about some of the other ripple effects to yeah. this? Because I don't think that people really talk about some of the things that excess weight can keep you from.
Yeah, and PCOS is a wonderful example, but this phrase Ozempic baby
yeah.
raises significant concerns from
yeah.
my perspective.
Yeah.
My colleague, Dr. Sharon Herring, who is also an internal medicine physician who does a lot of work with helping women lose weight during the postpartum period, just presented to our group yesterday, ironically enough, and I was tempted to ask her, what's your thought about mm-hmm. using Ozempic in women with PCOS who are looking to have a baby within the next year, or using Ozempic on someone who's just had a baby but thinking about a second child in the next year from now. And I think, Dr. Gordon, please chime in here, I think this is an area where we've got to be really thoughtful and really careful about how these medications are used, and that we don't have patients responding to the shiny object of the commercials and the talk shows.
Because that went viral on TikTok.
Bingo.
That's something part of the conversation. And Mara, if you want to jump in on that.
Yeah, I mean, infertility is a topic that's near and dear to my heart. Many of my patients face a lot of barriers accessing infertility care. It's often very difficult for publicly insured women to access infertility care. So I'm eager to see the evidence of, you know, more treatments we can use to help people who want to be biological parents become parents. But I don't think the research is there yet.
Right. So sometimes the hype is out ahead of the research. But then, as you said, David Sarwar, there is also this growing evidence that these drugs really do quite amazing things. And it is hard to keep both of those thoughts in your head. We're going to do that as we take a break. And on the backside of this break, we're going to hear a personal testimony from someone who has taken GLP-1s. You're listening to Studio 2 on WHYY. Our big question today is pretty basic. Would you be willing to take Ozempic or similar drugs to lose weight? And how do you think this is changing the game when it comes to weight loss? What's your take? Email us, studio2@whyy.org, or give us a call, 888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
The candidates for November are set.
Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
Welcome back. I'm Cherry Gregg, and this is Studio 2.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt, and we've been talking this hour about Ozempic, Wegovy, and all this huge class of drugs that's originally designed to treat diabetes but is now being used for weight loss. And our question to you this hour is, would you be willing to take Ozempic or similar drugs to lose weight? If you take them, how have they affected you? And how do you think drugs like Ozempic and Wegovy are changing the game when it comes to weight loss? Call us, 888-477-9499. Or email studio2@whyy.org.
And let me reintroduce our two guests that we have in studio. We have David Sarwar, Director of the Center for Obesity Research and Education at Temple University's College of Public Health. We also have Mara Gordon, Assistant Professor of Family Medicine at Cooper Medical School of Rowan University. And on the line, I want to bring in our third guest, Julie Simonson, a psychotherapist in private practice in Wayne, Pennsylvania, who has experienced her own significant weight loss on one of these GLP-1 drugs. Julie, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you for having me.
And so, Julie, could you tell us a little bit about your weight loss journey and what it's been like for you?
Sure. It's pretty long, so I'll try to condense.
Yes.
I am 51, and my entire adult life, I struggled with my weight and obesity. In July of 2010, I had bariatric surgery at Temple, and I lost 160 pounds. I struggled to maintain the loss. In fact, I think like the day I sort of hit my quote unquote goal weight, I think by the next day, I was able to start eating more again. And then my weight went up and down through 2017. I had another stint where I like took off some weight. And then during the pandemic, I had a lot of regain. And then I finally was able, through a lot of white knuckling, I lost 80 pounds. And then I stalled for about 4 to 5 months. And I was still a good 40 to 45 pounds away from where I had kind of hoped to realistically end up. So I asked my doctor about the medication, and she said, sure. I was really lucky in that one thing that we haven't talked about is how it's prescribed. You know, you take maybe for a month what's called a loading dose of 2.5 milligrams, well, depending on which medication it is. And depending on how you tolerate it, they'll titrate as needed. I was really lucky. I never titrated above 2.5, which is very, I know it's unusual. I think we're all sort of guinea pigs a little bit right now. I think even maintenance people don't, like, because now I'm maintaining. And anyway, I lost 45 pounds. I went on the meds in July of 2023. And by March of this year, I was done losing and maintaining.
Wow. Wow. That was pretty quick. Yeah. Yeah.
So it's been over a year now, Julie.
Yes, it's been over a year. But the weight loss wasn't, if you, you know, July to March to lose 40, 45 pounds is not, that's a reasonable amount of time. Mm.
What's the journey been like for you psychologically, sort of watching this happen over the course of the past year with all of that history behind you dating back to 2010 and before? Psychologically, what is the last year? Can you sum that last year up for us?
Well, I feel very gaslit by the medical community. Hmm. You know, I really deeply regret having bariatric surgery, and I'm curious to see down the road how this might be competition to bariatric surgery. Hmm. I have a lot of grief over what my life could have been like had I not spent most of it morbidly obese. This is terrible, but I'm treated so much better, and that kills me. Like, it
day-to-day interactions.
Yeah. Just, it is palpable how people are nicer and more interested and give you a chance. And you know, that's terrible, because I fundamentally, I am exactly the same person, just in a smaller body.
Wow. Yeah, I can only imagine. Thank you so much, Julie, for sharing your story. And I want to get your reaction to that, David. You're listening to what she's saying about the psychological impacts of trying to lose this weight, and being gaslit in a lot of ways, she said, by not getting, you know, she had to ask for this medication when it probably could have just been prescribed to her sooner, since it's been around for so long. Your reaction, David?
I mean, there's a lot we could talk about in Julie's history and her experience, but let's focus on that last year.
Yeah.
And you know, unfortunately, we know that weight stigma and bias, if not outright discrimination, is rampant in our society.
Mm-hmm.
And so even among healthcare professionals, when you would think we all should know better,
yeah.
Dr. Gordon and I have, you know, it's in the literature. We've probably witnessed it personally and professionally of colleagues making inappropriate comments, you know, ignoring available treatments for patients and so forth because of their own beliefs. I think while we have a greater awareness of this problem, we still have a long way to go to solve it. And while I do think that medical schools are doing a much better job than years ago in terms of educating their medical students about obesity and patient-centered care, it's going to take time until we really get it right in terms of treating patients with obesity with the respect and dignity that any medical patient deserves.
And quick follow-up question for you, Mara. Do the drugs help us change the way we view obesity? Do we now look at it as a disease versus, you know, this is something that people are just undisciplined and they just need to eat less and work out more? That was the kind of view that people had of folks who were overweight before. Have these drugs changed that?
Yeah, I mean, even in med school 10 years ago, right, I think the dogma was very much like, this is an issue of willpower. And I think the tides are turning a bit, that we're starting to understand some of the really complex hormonal and metabolic, you know, issues that are at play in the body when, you know, people are at different body weights. But I do want to, and Julie, I believe it is, thank mm-hmm. you so much for sharing your story.
Yeah.
I mean, that's very moving, and that's why I do the work that I do as an advocate against fat phobia, and particularly medicalized fat
yes.
phobia, right? Experiences of weight discrimination in healthcare. That's my crusade. But I do want to push back against the idea that, you know, obesity is necessarily a disease, right? So obesity is defined by body mass index greater than 30. Mm. And body mass index is considered a vital sign in healthcare, right? It flashes red in the computer system I use at work. If somebody has a BMI over 26, which we know that 70% of Americans have a BMI mm-hmm. over 26, mm-hmm. right? And it is it's really just considered a cornerstone. But it has some really wacky origins. And I think it's worth briefly delving into it.
Talking about BMI.
Body mass index has some wacky origins, right? And obesity is defined by BMI. So it was developed in the 19th century by a Belgian astronomer and mathematician, this guy named Adolphe Quetelet. Sorry for my French accent.
That sounded good to me.
Thank you, thank you. And he was obsessed with finding and defining the average man, right? Mm. And the average man was white. He was Belgian. He was a man. Wasn't a woman. Wasn't a child. Wasn't elderly. Right. Like, and if you read some of his original writings, I mean, they're pretty bonkers.
Right.
And here we are, you know, centuries later, continuing to use this metric as a core vital sign in healthcare. Right. And it really doesn't have the strongest scientific foundation.
So I think what you're getting at is the idea mm-hmm. that people can be definitionally obese but perfectly healthy.
Absolutely. And I think there's increasing research on what's called metabolically healthy obesity, exactly what you're talking about.
So then from your perspective as someone who can prescribe, from a clinician's perspective, like how do we differentiate between who is obese and might have health problems related to that and does need to lose some weight to forestall those problems, perhaps prevent those problems, and someone who is definitionally obese but should not go on a drug like this because their health is not threatened by their obesity. How do you distinguish between those two groups of people?
Yeah, I mean, I'll briefly say that I don't feel like my role as a clinician is to withhold medications for my patients that are widely available. So, you know, basically, if my patients want to start a GLP-1 agonist and they have a BMI, I'm going to give it to them. Yeah. But because patient bodily autonomy is the core of everything that I do as a clinician. But I will say that, you know, and BMI doesn't reflect, it's not that there's no relationship between adipose right. tissue and risk of cardiometabolic disease. It's just where it is in the body, right? So fat that's around the internal organs tends to be higher risk than right. fat in the hips and legs, for example. And women tend to have different body mm-hmm. fat distributions in their bodies than men, right? And so BMI is a very male-centric metric that just really lacks the precision I would want to use in rigorous clinical medicine, right?
So are you worried it's going to be overprescribed then as a result of this? People are going to be told, well, mm-hmm. or they're going to ask for it. They're going to meet the definition because their BMI is 28 or whatever. And they'll go on this drug even if, you know, they could live a perfectly healthy life otherwise. Is that a risk here?
I mean, I think it's a risk in that culturally we're not addressing the root causes of fat phobia, like, and as I mentioned, which are really related to racism and sexism. So I think we have a lot of grappling with discrimination that we need to be doing. And the idea that everybody's going to magically become skinny on these medications, it's not going to fix the root causes.
Yeah, right? And I want to bring in one more caller before we wrap up. Jay from Mercer County, New Jersey, says, there needs to be more ways to treat obesity. Jay, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment? And keep it brief, please.
Hi. I will keep it very brief. When COVID hit, I realized I would gain a lot of weight. So I reached out to the Cornell Weill Weight Loss Clinic under Dr. Louis Aroni. And their starting treatment was metformin for non-diabetic patients, which costs 35 cents for a month's supply because it's a 100-year-old drug in generic. And yet, I can't help but be cynical when studies are being done on GLP-1 agonists because they cost $1,000 a month.
Yeah. You're saying it's a cash grab, essentially.
And where is the discussion about metformin in particular as part of the overall treatment?
Yeah, okay. And Jay, thank you from Mercer County.
Thank you so much.
And my question to you, David, ties to what Jay had to say because there are other treatments, right, mm-hmm. that are much cheaper.
Yeah.
Also, I mean, is this a Band-Aid? Because the real issue is, right, we have a society where we don't walk anymore. We sit down all the time. Like, you know, yes, we had people who were overweight as our ancestors, my grandmother, for example, you know, but we've sort of redesigned society to make us, you know, less active. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I know we're heading to the top of the hour, but I guess I would just say in brief that I think it's really important that people listening today realize that these medications play an important role. They're much needed, as our most recent caller just said. They are one of many different medications and many different types of interventions that are out there, many of which are, in fact, evidence-based. The challenge is getting physicians who are learning about these medications, learning about these interventions, implementing them in practice, or making evidence-based referrals, and most importantly, treating patients with respect and compassion and not the proverbial blaming of the victim when they're working with a patient with obesity. But Sherry, you're absolutely right. I mean, this is just one drop in the bucket of all of the other issues that we need to be thinking about and addressing if we're going to push back against the significant public health problem of obesity.
All right, so let's end here. Dr. Mara Gordon, you look at the whole landscape of this. The emerging popularity of these drugs. You see the commercials everywhere. I'm sure patients are asking about them all the time. Quickly, where do you see hope and where do you see pessimism in this whole conversation?
I see hope in some amazing activism for my medical students starting at Cooper Medical School of Roan University, have started an organization called Medical Students for Size Inclusivity that's fighting to end medicalized fat phobia from the ground up in the med school curriculum. They're amazing. Go check out their website. They're doing amazing work. Pessimism, I would say, you know, just the continued fat phobia that we see in society and the way that it seeps into what should be rigorous evidence-based medical care. And we're seeing a lot of cultural fat phobia sort of seeping into what really should be medical issues.
Well, there you have it. We have to leave it there. That's Mara Gordon, Assistant Professor of Family Medicine at Cooper Medical School of Roan University. Thanks so much for your time this hour.
Thank you so much for having me.
We also heard from David Sarwar, Director of the Center for Obesity Research and Education at Temple University's College of Public Health. David, thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
And I want to shout out one more time Julie Simonson, who we heard from earlier in the hour, psychotherapist in private practice. From Wayne, Pennsylvania. And thanks to all our callers this hour and this whole week. That's it for Studio 2 this week, Jerry.
Yes, Studio 2 is produced by Debbie Builder, Paige Murray-Besser, and Andreas Copes. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. Al Banks engineered today's show. Joan Isabella is WHYY's audio general manager. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. We will talk with you next week.